Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Alexandria Bombeck's award-winning documentary On Her Shoulders is a portrait of a remarkable young woman, Nadja Murad, the winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Nadja was an accomplished student and athlete hoping to start a hair salon when ISIS invaded Sinjar, her village, in August 2014. But after she escaped from the unspeakable cruelty of the jihadist militant group, Nadja took it upon herself to bring the world's attention to its program of genocide against the Yazidi ethnic minority in Iraq and to the plot of the women and children still being held in captivity. Joining me now are the film's director, Alexandria Bombeck, an award-winning cinematographer, and its co-producer, Elizabeth Schaefer-Brown, a resource mobilization and communications professional focused on projects designed to counter violent extremism through education, partnership, development, fundraising, branding, and media. On Her Shoulders is playing at the East Village Cinema and Lincoln Center, and I'm very pleased it has brought Alexandria Bombeck and Elizabeth Schaefer-Brown, who we are speaking to in Qatar, to our show now. So is that true, Elizabeth? You're in Qatar right now?
Yes, I just arrived.
What are you planning to do there?
From the UAE.
And what are you planning to do there?
We are trying to build Nadi's initiative right now, and really traveling to every country, meeting with leaders, and trying to get all the verbal support they've given us to turn it into material action so that we can, you know, bring change on the ground to Sinjar.
Maybe we should start by talking about the Yazidis. That's a strange religion, right? A mix of a whole bunch of different traditions?
Alexandra, do you want to give the background?
Alexandria?
Oh, hi. It's a religious minority in northern Iraq, and it's a very ancient religion and historically very persecuted in the area. This is the 73rd genocide that the Yazidis have gone through.
Really? It's a religion based on pre-Islamic Assyrian traditions, Sufi and Shiite Islam, Nestorian Christianity, and Zoroastrianism. It sounds complicated. And it's in the Kurdish part of Iraq?
Yes.
How many Yazidis are there?
There are about 900,000 in the world. There are currently about 250,000 living outside of Sinjar, just outside of Sinjar in IDP camps in Kurdistan. And the rest are mostly in Europe.
So about 500,000 in Europe. In August 2014, when ISIS took over, didn't they call for the systematic destruction of the Yazidis? That's a genocide?
Yes.
Is that because they're not Sunni Muslims?
No, because Yazidis, because they don't have an official book, they are considered, and they're considered worshippers of the devil. They are the lowest rung.
So you could do whatever you want with them. When they took over the Sinjar, they killed 700 people, separated mothers from their children, took all the girls age 9 and above. The Nadja Murad, she saw most of her family die. She was raped and made into a sexual slave?
Yes.
How long was she held captive?
She was held captive for about a month before she escaped.
And it must have been difficult to escape because so many people have not been able to. Is it
and actually, an important thing to note, and what the media often doesn't cover, is the fact that 3,000 women and children are still in captivity. And the genocide is really continuing because these women are in captivity and because the Yazidis are still unable to return to their homeland of Sinjar, which is why we're so focused right now on trying to get nation states to help rebuild. So to, you know, literally take it off Nadia's children.
How old was Nadia when ISIS took over her village?
Alexandria, what's the exact age?
She was 21.
Oh, so she's still very young.
She's 25 now.
Does she know what happened to her brothers? Or her father was killed, wasn't he?
Her father was killed previously, but her mother was killed during the attack, and then many of her brothers died, but she still has one brother alive and two sisters, right, Elizabeth?
Yes, that's correct.
Is her village still in the hands of ISIS?
No. ISIS has mostly been cleared out of Sinjar and the surrounding areas. So, but the issue now is that, you know, what they left is landmines. Basically, to summarize, Sinjar is a land of landmines, mass graves, and political disputes.
Yeah, we see
only 70,000 Yazidis live there now. And, you know, I actually almost on a daily basis get photos of some who have, you know, they try to return home and they get blown up when they walk into their homes. I get images of women who need to be bought back. So, you know, if we're getting this information, clearly this community has very few options.
And when ISIS left, they took the women and children with them?
They took some of them, yes. And yes.
What was Nadia's life before they came to her town?
She describes her life as being very simple. She knew everyone. It was a very small community. Everyone knew her name. The family lived off a farm. They had no internet. She was the only one going to school, and she dreamed of owning her own hair salon.
Which was rather a modest goal, but perhaps that would have been something big in a town like hers. So the Yazidi villages are now free from ISIS, and you said that some of the women were taken with them. What happened to the others?
Well, some have been released. We don't obviously know what happened to all of them, but many were killed, some escaped. A lot of the children, you know, left with the families and don't even realize that they're in captivity. They don't know their real names. They don't know who their parents are. So it's a complicated issue.
Nadia says that she wants people to know that her activism is not a job. She's obviously a reluctant activist. Her life is far different from somebody who would have had a hair salon.
Yes, it is. I mean, she felt like she had no choice.
Well, how did becoming the spokesperson for the Yazidi cause fall on her shoulders, as the title of the film suggests?
Well, she, I'm trying to think how to summarize it. Back in 2015, this was before, you know, Nadia started speaking out, we joined the nonprofit Yazda, which the film features, to start a campaign to bring ISIS, to bring justice to ISIS through the criminal court. This started in the summer of August 2015. In September, we brought the case to the International Criminal Court. And they accepted to look at the case, and it's still sitting there in review. And after that, we realized that we needed to do a lot of campaigning around the idea to draw attention to what was happening, because the world was not paying attention. No, barely anyone realized there was a genocide occurring in Iraq. And I guess it was in November, the UN Security Council was looking for a survivor to speak in front of the council. And I think they had a Boko Haram woman was supposed to speak and then wasn't able to make it. So a colleague of mine, you know, called a guy from Yazda who was in Iraq, who flew to Germany and actually found Nadia, because she had spoken at somewhere in Germany, and she offered to come and speak. And then that's, I think, Alexandria, that's sort of when the film begins, right? During that historic moment.
How did you hear about it, Alexandria?
I remember and followed the news when the genocide started in August of 2014, and I remember seeing a video of Nadia's testimony at the UN Security Council in December of 2015. But this film really follows Nadia in the summer of 2016, in the midst of where she was, you know, going at a very blinding speed with campaigning with Yazda and doing interviews and meetings and testimonies, and on her shoulder, it really follows her during that period of time.
Now, Yazda is a U.S.-based nonprofit group that is seeking to help the Yazidis. Is it a Yazidi group?
It's a Yazidi organization that was started after the genocide started to help Yazidis, and they were working with Nadia at the time for her advocacy campaign.
How well does she speak English?
I think she speaks English pretty well now, right?
But she's learning it during the course of the film.
Yes, she just did her first full speech in English the day before she won the Nobel. Uh-huh. I think she's becoming very fluent naturally.
So she was in Germany, but weren't Nadia and some family members initially relocated to a Yazidi refugee camp in Kurdistan? Iraq, how did that come to pass? And what were the conditions like there?
I mean, I can't really speak to that. I was at one of those camps a year after she left her captivity. I've been to many refugee camps throughout my life, and it was definitely the starkest environment I've been in. I mean, there wasn't even soccer balls. The kids were kicking sticks. You know, there were children. I remember that the children were, there was one child same age as my son who was watching TV looking for his parents. It was a show put on by ISIS. It was devastating.
I'm speaking on Leonard Lopate at Large today with filmmaker Alexandria Bombeck and with Elizabeth Schaefer Brown, who is, what would you say your role is in this film, Elizabeth?
Well, so I'm a co-producer, but I was the one who brought the idea to Riot. We came to Riot roughly about the same time we went to the International Criminal Court, when no one was paying attention to the genocide. And we were trying to raise awareness, and they were actually one of the only media companies that was willing to run the story on what we were doing.
So they funded you.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, so they gave you funding, and they're distributing the film?
No, Riot before, they don't just do films, they were doing news. So they did a short news piece on what we were doing, and you know, tried to actually help us collect signatures to get world leaders to refer our case to the International Criminal Court. I mean, that requires a little bit of a background understanding of how that process works. But they were one of the only media companies to take us seriously. And then, you know, we stayed in touch with them, obviously, after that. And I think it was probably a few months after Nadia made her speech at the UN Security Council, they offered to, you know, take it to another level and start production on this film.
Alexandria Nagy says that she went from the refugee camp in Iraq to Germany with 1,000 other young women for treatment. Who arranged that?
That's an organization that has been doing that kind of work. I'm not sure of the name of it.
And what kind of treatment did she receive? She says in the film that she saw a psychologist but realized the best therapy would be to help others.
That's the extent of my knowledge of the treatment that she got. I didn't delve into the exact type of treatment that she received.
So you say that it really began for her in 2015 when she testified in front of the United Nations Security Council. What did she ask the Security Council to do?
I think at that time it was a big part of her, of the ask was to recognize the genocide and to justice was a big part of this, and also accepting refugees. Elizabeth, do you want to expand on that? I think that's what she was asking for at the time.
Just basic, yes, just to stop the genocide, which is still going on.
And the UN hasn't really acted, but we'll get to that later. But she has had supporters. Simone Manasibian, the UN Office of Drugs and Crime, helped Nagy speak at the UN.
There's
been many of people who have come to help Nadia and try and get her to speak, but I mean, really, you know, it's people like Elizabeth and people around her now that are doing the work with Nadia's initiative. And but the film really is focusing on Nadia's work in those 3 months and trying to get people to understand the weight of that's on Nadia's shoulders to repeat her story over and over again. So just wanting people to understand that on her shoulders isn't necessarily a history of the Yazidis or what has happened, but it really follows Nadia during this time of her campaign where she had to give many testimonies and many speeches and many interviews at a very relentless pace, and hoping the audience will come away reflecting on the weight that we put on survivors of these kind of horrific events.
Some of them are quite emotional. I found my eyes tearing a few times.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think for the first time, it's really hopefully giving people a behind-the-scenes look at of what it's like between, you know, a journalist and a survivor, or giving a behind-the-scenes look of what it's like to be an activist for something you wish you had never happened in the first place. You know, it's a behind-the-scenes look of the UN and how chaotic that can be. The film follows Nadia in those 3 months going to refugee camps and really gives another look at, you know, how complicated this issue is, because even with, you know, spreading Yazidis around the world, that would, in a way, almost complete the genocide because of the separation of the diaspora.
And that's something that was suggested by Luis Moreno Ocampo, who it was a former prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. He suggests it's a kind of genocide because people are being split up, and so there is no way to maintain a unified culture.
That was a part of the conversation while we were in one of the refugee camps. It was first suggested by the a Yazidi man who asked that question, and Luis confirmed it, that he understood that that was what was going on.
Now, a key player in all of this is a man named Murad Ismail. How did he get involved, and is it just a coincidence that his name is Murad?
It's just a coincidence. Yes. Murad is the director of Yazda, and he was involved right from the very start. There was a group of people from Yazidis from Houston that actually went to D.C. to protest and try and make more awareness about the genocide, and that group of people that was there, a lot of them became what is now the New Yazda organization.
And he served as Nadja's translator and guide as she was learning on the job. She's convinced that Murad Ismail set aside what she calls his human right to have a family to take on the Yazidi cause.
Yes, we talk about that in the film, just how, and I think it's a reflection of just how dedicated everyone is and how desperate the situation is. So much of this, of, you know, the passion and the relentless struggle that everyone's experiencing comes from, you know, survivor's guilt, because there are still people in captivity, and the situation is very dire, and so people have put aside their lives. And something that happens on our shoulders is we see that, you know, people kind of use that passion and dedication to almost take advantage of the story of Nadia, you know, and sensationalize her being a sex slave and you know, telling that story over and over again, you know, great trauma, re-traumatizing of Nadia to have to repeat that over and over again under the guise that that's important to do. And so a big part of the film is kind of trying to reflect and have a better dialogue around what kind of responsibility storytellers have to survivors.
Nadia reports that many interviewers ask questions like, did you try to resist your rapists, and couldn't you talk to them? What's the impact of insensitive questions like that on a victim who's gone through something like Nadia?
I can jump in here because I spend so much time with Nadia, and I can say that it really traumatizes her. She has to relive, you know, that experience every time the reporter asks. So now we actually ask media to not ask that question, and to ask her, you know, what is her vision for the Yazidi community? What is her work right now? And really try to stay away from that.
And she says she wishes interviewers would ask her questions like, how can we prevent women from being the victims of war? Although I'm not sure there's an answer to that question. Alexandria, you want to jump in on that?
Well, there was I asked Nadia at one point, you know, after seeing her give so many different interviews and testimonies, in our interview, I asked, you know, I've seen people ask you these questions over and over again, what would you like them to ask? And she lists very eloquently many different questions that she wished the world would ask of her instead. And it definitely was a turning point for me in the film. I obviously knew already that I wasn't going to make this, you know, a generic story about an activist. I wanted to kind of point out the problematic sides of this. But at that point in the interview, it just really clicked with me that, you know, this needed to really point out how we're not hearing these survivors. We're not hearing Nadia. We need to be rethinking how we're approaching and packaging these stories of trauma.
In an op-ed she wrote for The Guardian, Nadia described how ISIS had carefully planned the kidnapping of the girls of her village to use them as sex slaves, and how they included sex slaves in their glossy propaganda magazine, Dabiq, as an incentive for new recruits. Do you think most people are aware of the extent to which the victimization of women in war is institutionalized? Elizabeth?
I think they're aware of a very, it's hard to address that question, actually.
Well, we hear about it in different situations in Africa, for example, but in Nigeria, every time, it's just so shocking.
I think it depends, you know, it obviously depends on where you are. I mean, certainly in the U.S., no one knew that this was happening to the Yazidis. And really, I feel until Nadia started speaking out about it. But then, you know, as Alexandria documents, they really mostly paid attention to a lot of the, honestly, sexual details of her captivity.
Now, how does a group like ISIS justify this sort of thing, because these people are not Because they're not believers, so they can you can do anything to them?
I think they were just the most vulnerable group in that area, and so they took advantage of that.
But they're also not of, you know, they're not of the book, so that makes them it makes it acceptable.
Well, is this some, and we have seen in civil wars all throughout the world that one of the ways that that the campaign, well, that women are constantly victims. They're raped as a way of dehumanizing the group that you're fighting against. I'm speaking on today's Leonard Lopate at Large with Alexandria Bumbach, the director, and Elizabeth Schaefer Brown, one of the producers of a new film called On Her Shoulders, which is currently at the East Village Cinema and Lincoln Center. It has won any number of awards already. Is it up for an Oscar? Do we know?
That's not something we know.
But you couldn't have known when you made the film that she was going to win the Nobel Peace Prize either.
We didn't know up until the minute it happened. It was a complete surprise.
We will continue our conversation right after this.
دستی خواب ده دستی من لی درونیا هی ویدا دستی خواب ده دستی من لی درونیا هی ویدا
لو برده لو برده لو دستی من برده
Edie Music. We're talking about the Nobel Peace Prize winner who has taken on the cause, reluctantly, of the Yazidi people. The film is called On Her Shoulders. And it's obvious that this is something that she really didn't want to have to do, but felt she had no choice in the matter. There must have been other people out there, older, who could have also taken on these responsibilities. Why did it fall on Nadja's shoulders?
I think there were a lot of people, and still are a lot of Yazidi people, who are speaking out about this. I think Nadia was uniquely positioned after that UN Security Council speech to really take this on fully. And, you know, Nadia is such a unique human being, too. She just is incredibly gracious and patient with people and dedicated to speaking out, and had a the bravery to repeat her story over and over again. But Nadia would be the first person to point out that she's not the only survivor doing so.
She and Murad Ismail and some other Yazda people also went to Parliament Hill in Ottawa to speak before an immigration committee in Canada, hoping to get Canada to declare the Yazidis victims of genocide. What happened as a result of her testimony?
I think there have been a few different things that have happened. There have been Yazidis that were brought to Canada, but it wasn't nearly the number that they were hoping for at that time. I'm not too sure about what exactly is still going on, but I know it's still something they're working on. Elizabeth, is there any update in Canada?
No update.
Did they go to Washington to gain support? Or is the climate in Washington too anti-immigrant at this point?
Actually, there have been very few governments that have responded to our request for action. However, France and the U.S. have actually helped us in concrete material ways. They started the mining the region of Sinjar to allow the possibility now for Yazidis to return out of the IDP camps. And this happened this year as a result, largely as a result of Nadia's initiative to activism around the issue.
There are shots near the end of the film of Sinjar today, and it looks pretty much destroyed. They're going to have to rebuild pretty much all the homes.
Yes.
Now, Nadia got a very warm reception in Canada when she visited the Canadian MPs, but you say that didn't necessarily lead to changes in policy?
I mean, I think they accepted more Yazidi refugees, mm-hmm. which is helpful. I mean, every family that's helped matters. But no, I don't think there's been any huge policy changes yet.
Does it make you sad contrasting what happened in Canada to U.S. policies? Yazidi, there's been no mention of a genocide in the United States.
They did label, the United States did label the genocide. I think it was probably back in 2016. Mm. John Kerry led that motion, but actually the U.S. has been better than other countries when it's come to helping the Yazidi community.
Nadia was made a goodwill ambassador by whom?
The United Nations Drug and Crime Office. Mm-hmm.
And what did that appointment mean for her? Was it a turning point in her quest for justice?
Alexandra, do you want to?
Well, I mean, that happened towards the end of when I was following Nadia. I think it's complex. Obviously, these, accolades are really important in getting more awareness on the issue, but it's also in the film, trying to point out how complicated this kind of pageantry from the UN and others can be for Nadia, because it's difficult to celebrate an accolade when there's still so much to be done and it doesn't feel like the world's moving very quickly at all.
She's the first UN ambassador on human trafficking who's herself a survivor of trafficking.
It has been very helpful for the advocacy because it gives her a position and a platform to connect with global leaders who do have the ability to affect change on the ground and through policy. So it's definitely been a good thing, which is why she renewed it this summer.
And then, of course, winning the Nobel Prize helps her cause a little more.
It's overwhelming. It helps it a lot. It already has in the last week or so.
Can you tell us about the title of this film, Alexandria, On Her Shoulders? Watching it, I sometimes had the feeling that Nadia has too much on hers. For instance, there's a scene where she's about to address a crowd of Yazidis in Berlin, and she's crying, and she's cautioned that the crowd gets its strength from her, so if she cries, they will cry. And then later on, she's told she has to come up with a 10-year solution for the Yazidis. That's putting an awful lot on her shoulders.
She has. And she's actually done it.
She's come up with that 10-year solution?
It's called the Sinjar Action Fund. If you go to nadiasinitiative.org, there is a section labeled SAF, which stands for Sinjar Action Fund. And it is a call to action to nation states, and really, everyone around the world to contribute to rebuilding Sinjar.
Does she want revenge against ISIS? Has she ever talked about that?
She wants justice.
Amal Clooney is also working on behalf of the Yazidis, isn't she, Alexandra? What's she doing?
Amal Clooney and her team are still working on, finding justice for the Yazidis against ISIS members who have committed these crimes. As far as my knowledge is, no ISIS members have been brought to justice yet for these crimes. Is that still the case, Elizabeth?
Yes. Yeah.
Murad Ismail says that since there are only a 500,000 people in exile, Yazidis should understand their limited weight in the world, considering the fact that there are 60 million refugees worldwide from various other groups. So he says they have to be patient, persevere until the injustice ends. That's kind of a difficult thing for anyone to hear.
Yeah, I think, you know, at the time, you know, and still now, you know, there's over 65 million refugees. And I think Murad just wanted to really point out just how dire the situation is. And, you know, being someone who has tried to get the world's attention for so long, he was very aware of the weight that Yazidis had compared to other groups.
When Nadja addressed the UN General Assembly, what did she ask of them? Alexandria?
I think, I mean, her speech is in the film, and I encourage people to, and that full speech is actually online. I think it's important to hear that from her own words, but she's asking for the things that she's always asked for, is recognition and justice and support for Yazidis who need help immediately, and also for the reconstruction and demining of Sinjar.
She says, if beheading, taking women as sex slaves, raping children, and the displacement of families will not move you, when will you move?
Yes, that's the final line in the film.
Rather eloquent. Does she write her own speeches?
As far as my knowledge goes, that was a big part of, you know, all of her speech writing.
In September 2017, the UN Security Council passed a resolution to investigate the war crimes of ISIS against the Yazidi. Is Nadja satisfied with that? That is not the same thing as actually taking steps to stop what ISIS has been doing.
I think it was a first step, and I think that team has been formed and sent to Kurdistan for investigation. Elizabeth, do you have any updated as far as how that has gone?
It's just starting to form, and they haven't actually gotten to Kurdistan yet.
Well, Elizabeth, how would you want the UN and the world to respond to this genocide? What actions do you think must be taken?
Now? I mean, now it's clear. Now that ISIS has been, you know, cleared out of the territory, the homeland needs to be accessible to the community. So every nation state needs to contribute to the rebuilding of this homeland. And what's happening now is that all the money that is being given to Iraq for reconstruction is going to places like Mosul, who are not then reallocating the money to the Sinjar for various, mostly political reasons. But that's what needs to be done.
So the government in Iraq does not really take the problem of the Yazidis all that seriously? They're concerned about
their own problems? Now. I think the world is now. I think they're starting to listen. And I think in the next couple months, you know, you will see the rebuilding of Sinjar start to happen.
Murad,
because of Nadia's actions.
So mostly because of her.
Yes,
you have to wonder what would have happened if someone who wasn't as
the genocide would have been the most successful genocide in history.
Murad,
Go ahead. I think ISIS would have been successful in their genocidal campaign against the Yazidis.
Murad Ismail suggests that if Yazidis ever do make it back to their homeland, it will be a culture of widows and orphans. So would it be possible for them to return to their traditional ways after all of this?
I mean, that's a hard question, and of course impossible to answer, impossible to know, but certainly something, you know, the whole world needs to try to see if it could be possible.
What are the circumstances of the refugee camps? Nadja, in the film, Nadja visits the Saris refugee camp in Greece.
Hold on one second. I'm being called away. Alexandria, can you step in?
Yeah. One of the camps that she went to, one of those camps that was actually emptied and everyone was able to make it to Germany. Of course, there's many different Yazidi camps in Greece, and people are still there, and some people have left. It's all over the map, but there are, of course, a lot of displaced people in Kurdistan as well.
There's been a movement against admitting refugees throughout the European countries, Greece one of them, Germany now. Are the Yazidis now faced with being unwelcome?
I mean, I think that's an ongoing changing landscape and depends on the country and depends on the issue, but it just varies completely. But I think that's a big part of the work that Nadia and her team and Elizabeth are doing.
What are the conditions in a place like the Saris refugee camp in Greece like? Its website makes it look like a summer camp with lots of activities and job training.
I don't think that's reflective of how people feel about their life situations right now. I think this is not ideal. At the time that I was there, it was, you know, definitely extremely hot, and people are living in caravans that are, you know, it's just getting by. Of course, that there's groups that are doing amazing work on the ground trying to make the most of a very desperate situation, and that's probably the website you saw.
Your first feature film, feature-length documentary, was Frame by Frame, which followed the lives of four Afghan photojournalists who were facing the realities of building a free press in Afghanistan. The Middle East is a rather troubled area right now. We have a major war going on in Syria. Saudi Arabia is in the news for a number of reasons, including its war in Yemen. Why do you think now?
Why do I think now what?
I mean, is it, for example, Afghanistan, how much is Western involvement responsible for some of these things? The United States had not asked for 9/11, which actually began in Afghanistan. But is there something different happening in the Middle East? It's always been an area that was kind of troubled, but right now it seems to be boiling over. Have thought that the Arab Spring, if anything, would have brought better conditions.
Wow. Well, I mean, you just went all over the map there.
Of course.
To Yemen, to Egypt, to Iraq and Afghanistan is in South Asia, not in the Middle East. And
yeah, but it is a Muslim country.
I think a big part of my work is trying to, you know, uncomplicate to complicate and make people think more critically about the specifics of what's going on versus general wide sweeps and simplification and of these stories. And I think that's a big part of the problem is generalizing and seeing, you know, this region is one large group of people. It's very complex. And I think in order for us to move forward, we need to not think of it as one big general group, because the issues going on in Afghanistan are much different than what the Yazidis are facing.
And in Afghanistan, it's the Taliban. In other parts of the Middle East, it is ISIS. ISIS still has a foothold in Syria. Would it be possible, even if you ousted ISIS from all of the areas that they have occupied, to end what they have put into place, what they've started?
You know, I won't pretend to be an expert on ISIS or the region or the situation that's going on there now or from before. I mean, I'm a documentary filmmaker and really focused on more of a character-driven story and a portrait of Nadia in this very particular time that she was going through in this very relentless campaign of trying to get the world to listen. A big part of On Her Shoulders is just focusing on, you know, the story of her telling her story over and over again, and our responsibility as journalists and documentary filmmakers to survivors and what our responsibility is to them, and when we're packaging these stories of trauma, and also to hopefully get the audience to really question the simplification of these stories of genocide, especially in a time where the migration crisis is, you know, still going on, and a lot of people have apathy about these issues.
At the end of your film, Nadia returns to Sinjar. What was that like for her?
I can't speak for her, but in the footage that I saw, it was a very traumatic experience. And a lot of that area is very devastated, so it was, I'm sure, very difficult.
Her personal life has been totally disrupted. Does she have much of a personal life now, or is she pretty much somebody who lives as a spokesperson?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I followed her at a time where they were saying yes to absolutely everything, and she was up, you know, very early and up very late just working on the cause. I think that she's, especially with her own initiative, with Nadia's initiative, been able to reclaim a lot of her autonomy, and I'm hoping that, I really hope for her that she's able to have a little bit more control over her life.
Elizabeth, are you back?
I am back, sorry.
Nadia has been very outspoken against ISIS. Does that put her in danger?
I mean, of course. I haven't witnessed specific threats from ISIS. But yes, I mean, it's a danger we're all always aware of.
So you don't know whether she's received death threats?
I mean, she did early on, you know, a few years ago. I am worried now that her profile, now that it's been raised because of the Nobel, that the, you know, the threats will definitely multiply. And we need to, you know, it's a struggle to figure out how to deal with that and not have that affect, you know, her need to have a personal life, which she's put on hold, you know, for the last 3 years, really.
I would imagine it would be impossible for her to ever achieve her original goal of starting a hair salon after all of this. I don't know. There are too many hair salons that are run by people who've won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes, but that's Nadia. So I think it's absolutely possible, and it wouldn't surprise me at all to see her open a salon in Sinjar and have the rest of the community be inspired, you know, to follow their own goals in the, you know, in Sinjar and beyond. And, you know, just speaking about her personal life, she recently announced her engagement to another Yazidi man who we work with also in the initiative. And after she announced that engagement, I think it was at the end of July maybe, or August, dozens of other Yazidi women announced their engagements. So it's beautiful to sort of see how much she influences the people in her community.
Right now it's playing at the East Village Cinema and Lincoln Center. What happens after those runs? Will we be able to see it on television, or will it be available online?
Yes, it'll be available online. We're also going to be screening with POV, which is very exciting. And I think we'll be on, you know, Amazon, iTunes, and things like that. But it's really wonderful to be able to see it in the theater, and I hope people are able to go.
Have you been able to show it at any of the refugee camps?
No, I hope we are able to.
because I think that I'm sure that many people in exile would be very interested in knowing about all these things going on that probably are totally unaware of.
Well, I think I mean everyone has like Facebook and everything like that, so people have been Yazidis that we met in the camps have been, you know, really supportive of the film.
Okay. Well, Elizabeth, right now you're in Qatar. Do we pronounce it Qatar or Qatar?
Any way you want. I'm still trying to figure that out.
Whenever I say Qatar, people look at me like I'm weird.
Same way. Same thing happens to me.
But are people open to discussing this in Qatar, which is a unique place in the Arab world?
Well, I literally just arrived, when I got on line with you. So I can't answer that question. We did come from the UAE, and they were incredibly open about discussing it and wanting to know more, especially we were at a conference that was mostly filled of women Nadia's age in Sharjah. So it broke a lot of stereotypes for me.
Has this been a big story on Al Jazeera?
On every media channel. Uh-huh. Oh, you mean the visit to the UAE?
The film and the story that you're telling here.
Well, Alexandria, has it been covered by Al Jazeera? I don't.
I think I don't, so at some point.
By everyone. I mean, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, the film's been out since January. We were at Sundance, so it's been covered by a lot of media outlets since then.
And you've been at a number of different film festivals, been winning awards, and of course, now just been winning a Nobel Prize. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Alexandria Bombeck and Elizabeth Schaefer Brown, to Susie Stultz, who prepared this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to the Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.